This is Dylan FM, a Freak Music Club podcast. I'm Bob Dylan. If you love Dylan, you're in the right place. This season, we're going deep on Time Out of Mind to celebrate its 25th anniversary. Here's your host, Craig Danieloff.
A new bootleg series is like an excellent Christmas morning for Bob Dylan fans. We get a shiny new present, it's just what we wanted, and yet it's full of mystery, surprise, and wonder. This year, Christmas came in late January with the Fragments box set from the Time Out of Mind sessions. And our guest today, like our guest last week, was one of Santa's little elves who worked to make this wonderful gift possible for all of us. Stephen Hayden wrote the liner notes, or more precisely, half the liner notes, for the bootleg series, Volume 17. Historian Douglas Brinkley wrote the context piece, sharing facts and observations about the making of the record and the songs it contains. And Hayden wrote the impact piece, sharing his thoughts on what the record meant to the world, to Dylan, and to himself. Stephen Hayden is a highly respected music writer who recently published a book called The Long Road on Pearl Jam, and is the author of two music books that make a lot of favorites lists, Your Favorite Band is Killing Me and Twilight of the Gods. He writes regularly at UpRocks, where he's officially the cultural critic, and he has a new Bob Dylan podcast focusing on live shows from the never-ending tour called Never-Ending Stories. Links to his books, articles, and the podcast are in the show notes. You'll definitely want to check them out. But outside of his professional credentials, Stephen Hayden is a Bob Dylan fanatic. He writes about, and tells us today, how he came of age and got deeply into Dylan right around the time of Time Out of Mind. And that's one of the reasons he was asked to contribute these liner notes. His essay, which hopefully you've read, and if you don't have the CD or the vinyl box, then maybe ask around and someone can help you with the PDF file. It talks about how Dylan was positioned and perceived in the media around 1997. And how that narrative didn't exactly align with reality, and how 25 years has utterly destroyed the popular assumptions of the time. In this conversation, we talk about how Stephen got the gig, what he was asked to do, and his thoughts on summing up 60 years of Bob Dylan. We talk about what it meant at the time for a 55-year-old to make this album, and the role Daniel Lanois played, plus what the new mix and the outtakes say about the album. And we get his thoughts on the live tracks that are included, the future of the bootleg series, and more. And now, here's our discussion with Stephen Hayden about his liner notes for the new Fragments Bob Dylan bootleg series. Steve Hayden, thanks. Welcome to Dylan FM, and thanks for coming to talk about Fragments, the bootleg series, and your great liner notes.
Well, thanks for having me.
So, how'd you get the gig? I mean, Bob called you up and asked if you had a little time?
No, fortunately, Bob didn't reach out. There's this guy named Jeffrey Schulberg, who's an executive at Sony Music, and we've corresponded a bit over the years. And I think it started because I wrote a column ranking all the Dylan records. And it was like a 10,000-word column, really went in depth. And I think he liked that piece. And then, you know, he would email me from time to time. And then about a year ago, it was like early 2022. Actually, it was late 2021, I think. He reached out and he was like, we're doing a box set for Time Out of Mind. And there's this idea that we'd like one of the writers to be a little younger, which I'm not young, I'm 45. But, you know, by the standards of like Dylan writers, you know, they wanted someone who was young, like when Time Out of Mind came out. And he thought, and he asked, like, would you want to do that? And I said, absolutely. And he's like, well, can you put together a little pitch for what you'd want to write? And we'll send it to Jeff Rosen. And we'll hear, you know, we'll see what he thinks. So that's what I did. And Jeff liked the approach. And that was that. And I wrote my essay, I think it was like in February or March of 2022. And then there was such a big lead time because of vinyl pressing. So like so anyway, what I wrote, it was a long time ago. Like, it was fun getting the box set last week because I had forgotten like what I had even said about the album. So yeah, it's been a long time coming, but it looks great, and I'm very proud to be a part of it. I mean, this album in particular was really big for me. It came out when I was 19. It was the first event Bob Dylan album of my lifetime. And I write about this in the essay. You know, I really think that record was the album that made him a contemporary music figure again. You know, I think before that album, he was basically defined as, you know, the voice of a generation from the 60s, protest singer, the guy who plugged in at Newport, you know, all the cliches about Bob Dylan. That was really how he was defined. And then from Time Out of Mind on, you know, it was really looking at each new album as a big deal, you know, in a way that I don't know that there's anyone of his generation that you would say the same of, you know, like,
right.
The new album might be, like, you go into a new album thinking this could be one of his best albums, you know, like there's no one I think from his generation really that has that same kind of stature. And so in my notes, I trace that back to Time Out of Mind.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in an incredible arc, it's a big turning point for sure. So you've written books, you've written all kinds of columns, you're a podcaster. Have you done liner notes before?
Yeah, I done it a few times. The first ones I did were for Being There, the Wilco album, when they reissued that. Forget when that was, you know, probably mid-2010s. So that was the first big one I did. I wrote liners for Jerry Garcia Band, like the live record, when that was reissued on vinyl. I did liner notes for a Thin Lizzy record, Jailbreak. But this is the biggest one for sure. And again, I mean, to have my name inside of a Bob Dylan record, that's like one of the proudest things of my career. Yeah, it's definitely a big deal. You know, even though I know most people are just going to stream this album, you know, or if they buy the set, they may not even read the liner notes, but I know they're in there. So it makes me happy.
I was going to ask you how you thought about the function of liner notes.
You know, I'm a traditionalist, so I love liner notes. And especially for something like this, you know, the bootleg series has such a great tradition. And even if you want to include Biograph in there too, which isn't a bootleg series release, but it was the first big Bob Dylan box set, and like Cameron Crowe, you know, interviewing Bob, and there's like a lot of cool things in those liner notes too. So, yeah, I mean, I think for someone like Dylan specifically, you know, it's like, I mean, I made a joke about this a second ago that most people are just going to stream the record. But I do know that with someone like Bob Dylan, there actually probably will be more people reading the liner notes than there would be for an average release, you know, just because Bob fans are so obsessive and they're going to seek things out. And I try not to think about that too much because you don't want to psych yourself out too much, like knowing that every expert who posts on Expecting Rain is going to be reading this and judging me based on their own extensive knowledge of Bob Dylan. I don't know. I really just tried to take more of a personal approach with what I wrote. And that, I think that was something that they were looking for too. Because, you know, for those who haven't gotten the box set yet, there's also an essay by Douglas Brinkley, who is a well-known historian, and he does more of the sort of blow-by-blow talking about each song and like how there's like lyrical differences on different takes on the record. Whereas mine is more of like a, you know, I was 19 in 1997 when this came out, and this was a record that meant maybe something different to people who were young versus people who had grown up with Bob Dylan. And I feel like that's a pretty common experience. Like, I know I'm not alone in having experienced the record that way. And, you know, and I've heard from people who have said as much to me. So, you know, hopefully that'll be a valuable, you know, bit of commentary, you know, that people appreciate with this record.
Yeah. Well, one thing your notes made me think about was that, which, you know, comes up, but I hadn't really drilled on it so much, was this idea of when each of us comes into the Bob Dylan story, you know, given that it's 60 years long and some people were there from the beginning, but others weren't. And you know, you describe your process of, you know, at 19 coming around, you know, being familiar with him, not so deep, all of a sudden going deep, then Time Out of Mind comes out. But people have to rearrange that history themselves and make sense of it. And
yeah,
you know, it takes a long time. You know, I've told the story before. I started a bit earlier than you, but I wasn't hardcore. And then by the time 95 came along, I saw a bunch of shows, but I knew I didn't have the timeline right. I didn't know the names of the songs yet. I didn't know, you know, this is the 60s and that's 70s and that's 80s. It just takes a while to draw the map. But how that affects your relationship with Bob is what I really never thought about. And you sort of brought that up in an interesting way.
Yeah. I mean, I think there is something to be said about experiencing a artist's work as it's coming out in a linear chronological fashion and just how that influences how you hear the new work. And, you know, in 1997, the history of Dylan's career, the narrative of Dylan's career was, you know, written by people who had come up with him. And when you have that perspective, inevitably the early work is going to shine brighter than stuff that comes later. Because where that person was in their life when they heard those records, like, they were different too. They were experiencing the world and things were fresher for them as well. So, like, yeah, if you were 18 when Blonde on Blonde came out, I mean, that sort of correlation there, that's of course going to shape how you hear that record. And it's not going to be the same feeling when you hear Infidels in your, you know, mid-30s. And what's different for someone who comes to this work later, and this was true for me in 97, you know, because, like, as you said, you know, when I was a younger teenager, I was certainly aware of Bob Dylan, but I couldn't make heads or tails of his songs. I mean, they were really long. There were a ton of words. You know, the voice was weird. Yeah, it's like, I know this is important, but I don't really get it. Like, I'm not connecting with it. And then around the age of 18, 19, there was like a lightning bolt hit me and everything just clicked into place. And not only did I understand it, but it was the only thing that I wanted to listen to. Like, I was obsessed with Bob Dylan, and anytime I got a paycheck from, you know, the part-time job I was working, I would just go to the record store and I would buy 3 or 4 CDs, you know, and I was buying records from all the different eras. So I wasn't listening to it chronologically. It'd be like, well, here's Desire, and here's Saved, and here's another side of Bob Dylan. And you're listening to all these different eras at the same time. And that old narrative about Bob Dylan that was written by sort of the original fans, it starts to break down a little bit. And not to say that one approach is better than the other, but, you know, when I talk to younger Bob Dylan fans, you know, they dig the records that when I was growing up, people said were garbage. You know, like, when I was first reading about Bob Dylan, it'd be like, don't even bother listening to Street Legal because that album is terrible.
Right. You know,
don't even bother with the Christian era because that stuff is awful. And now it's like, you know, obviously the 60s stuff is great, but you go to Street Legal at some point in your life and you're like, what? This album is great. Changing of the Guards and, you know, Journey Through Dark Heat, like, all, you know, there's so many great songs here. Like, who in the world would say this record's bad? You know, there's so many instances of that, I feel like, with Dylan. And then you get to the point where you're so obsessed with him that even the records you don't really like are still really interesting, because it's like, well, what was he thinking when he made Down in the Groove? Like, what in the world was going through his mind? I'm going to listen to this record 100 times so I could figure it out, because in a way that's more interesting than listening to the albums that everyone already knows are great. Like, I want to get to the bottom of this record that maybe is misunderstood.
Yeah. At the same time, you find out that while he's making Down in the Groove, you know, he's on the road with Petty, or he's doing these other things that completely belie, you know, this narrative.
Right.
Because
exactly.
There's way more than one thing going on. You had a line in there about Time Out of Mind where you say that passage of time has utterly confounded, you know, that story at the time. And I think that happens a lot with Bob, right? I mean, everything you just said about, you know, street legal's no good or the Christian period's no good is sort of this compacting way to tell a story. First of all, it's relativism. You know, you also point out the other, one of my things I repeat all the time about Bob asking not to be compared to himself.
Right.
Right. Because if you take Street Legal or Shot of Love or, you know, whatever, compare that album to almost anyone else, he's ahead. So he has to live in all these boxes inside of boxes. And then you get to the details and you go, oh, that summary was way off. It was convenient.
Well, and also, like, we have the luxury of, like, when you come to an artist like this, who already has a big body of work, and, you know, when I came to him in the 90s, he already had a big body of work. There is a luxury to having access to all of it at the same time. Like, I get somebody in 1978 who's been waiting a few years for a new Bob Dylan record, and then you get Street Legal, and you're like, what in the hell is this? Like, that album is so dense lyrically, and you know, there's just like metaphors on top of metaphors, and now there's saxophone on Dylan records. Like, why is this here? I mean, I can get someone who's had to wait 2 years for a Dylan record and it maybe not being what they would expect and then just rejecting it right away. I think that's like a fairly natural reaction for people who are experiencing this in real time. Whereas we get to go back as a younger Dylan fan. I say we, the royal we, for people who are like me or you who came later, where you can be like, I'm hearing all these records sort of at the same time or as a body of work. I can understand like how this connects, you know, the Desire era to the Christian era and all these things that maybe aren't apparent in the moment, but you can see later on. So, yeah, I mean, the funny thing with Time Out of Mind to me, and people forget this with Dylan, is that he had been given a Lifetime Achievement Award by the Grammys 6 years before that record came out. You know, he wasn't even 50 years old when he got a Lifetime Achievement Award. And it just speaks to how people thought he was done. You know, like you don't give someone a Lifetime Achievement Award if you expect them to keep putting out great records for like 30 more years. You know, you do it because you're like, okay, you've done your thing. Now you're just going to fade away. You're going to be like an oldies act. And, you know, just knowing that, it just adds another layer, I think, to that record about how it was kind of a miracle that he made a record that good. And then in the eyes of many people, he topped it, you know, going into the 2000s. But yeah, that still kind of makes me laugh a bit that, you know, Time Out of Mind was like this sort of, you know, looked at as this mortality record or this like career capstone record. And now in the chronology of his career, it's like kind of like a mid-career masterwork now, you know, like people want to call it a late career work still, but it's like, it's 25 years ago, you know, he's like continued putting out records. So it's like literally in the middle of his career at this point now.
Yeah, I actually wanted to talk about this. You start with this idea of the mortality record and you end with it. You know, the narratives that seemed true at the time and what we've learned, you know, and even what Fragments reveals, right? The songs, you know, are presented in ways that aren't slow and gloomy and morose. You know, so we get a view of the songs. I made a playlist of the what I called the strummers, so sort of the first week in Miami before Lenoir's production was there, before Dylan slowed down, when you're still in these mixes hearing strings and things you're not hearing. And I don't think the narrative we got would have came, I don't know if that should have been released, but if it would have, you know, it wasn't baked in the songs. I mean, the lyrics are the lyrics. Anyway, let's just talk about that, what the narrative was and how you think either time or this release, you know, shifts it.
Well, you know, certainly the the mood of the record is very melancholy, and there's something that Lanois heard in those songs that caused him to really layer on the atmospherics with this record. Which, by the way, I just want to say, I love the original production. I'm a Daniel Lanois fan.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I really love what he brought to the record. The thing with Bob is that, you know, obviously the Jack Frost era begins after this, but like even before, you know, like back in the 60s and 70s, it seems like he was basically his own producer. You know, like someone like Bob Johnston, for instance, my sense from like what I've read is that he was basically a guy to press record. You know, like he wasn't going to tell Bob what to do. And that's probably why Bob liked him, because, you know, he didn't want someone to make him record over and over again or to do fancy overdubbing, or he just like wanted to go in, knock out the songs with relative quickness. And Time Out of Mind, even more than Oh Mercy, I think is like the one record where Lanois, he isn't the co-star of that album, but he is a major presence on that record more than any other producer, like by far in Dylan's career. And I'm sure that just that alone probably irritated Bob. Again, I'm totally speculating here, but just my sense is that to have someone else making such an impact on the music that's not him, and Lanois getting a lot of credit for that too in the moment, my sense is that that maybe irked him. And that's how you end up with this remix, which I love the remix too. I love having this version, and you can contrast and compare. It's just like another thing to dive into with Dylan. But getting back to the mortality thing, I think the other thing, which again is maybe people forget now, but in 1997, like 56 was pretty old for a rock star. You know, like that originally, you know, you have the 50s rockers, obviously, who are a little bit older. But, you know, you didn't have 80-year-old rock stars, really, in 1997. So, like, I remember I saw the Rolling Stones for the first time a few years before that on the Voodoo Lounge tour. And my assumption at the time was that I have to see the Stones now because there's no way they're going to tour after this. These guys are, like, in their 50s. Like, there's no way these guys can tour. And here we are 30 years later.
And someone like the Stones, as other people have pointed out, if they were making albums, they weren't acting their age.
Right, exactly. Yeah, yeah, like Mick Jagger, and God love him for this, but like his whole thing is like, I can move as well as I did in 1969. And yeah, my face is more wrinkled, but, you know, I still have this like weird alien body that can like twist and run around stages, you know, and I don't know how much cardio and yoga that guy does to stay in shape, but it's pretty incredible. But yeah, like Dylan, you know, has never done that. Yeah, I mean, he's obviously in good shape. I don't mean that. I just mean, you know, he sounded like an old guy on that.
And yeah, he found a way to, you know, to embrace it. And then the other thing, yeah, and you obviously point this out, is that, you know, we had the cardiac issue right before, which gave the press. I mean, I've also heard people say that coincidentally, it set Bob up for the press to, you know, have a reason to shine him and put him up there because he gave them what they want, which is a super dramatic story, even if it was accidental, coincidental, and but it framed this in a way that, you know, maybe got him more coverage, more front pages, more things with even as good as this album was that he would have got if that hadn't happened.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, don't underestimate the power of a good narrative hook. I mean, I'm someone who works in music writing, and I can say that, you know, music journalists and critics, we're all lazy people. We like it when you just give us the angle that we need to write about a record. And Bob's health problems, it was an obvious hook. You know, this guy almost died, and now he's here with this spooky record where he's saying it's not dark yet, but it's getting there, and he's trying to get to heaven before they close the door, and all this stuff. It just becomes an irresistible hook for people. But I do think it is mostly about the music. Like, if this was a mediocre record, you know, that would have been a cute way to get in the door, but we still wouldn't be talking about it now. And again, I think that part of the power of the record was that Bob was not making a record that sounded like he was just trying to do what he did in the 60s, you know, which is, I think, what a lot of older musicians do when they have their comeback record. They make the record where they're like, well, this is reminiscent of what I did when I was at my peak. And Bob didn't do that. He made a record that he could have only have made when he was 56. And it worked. And it was as powerful as what he had done before, but in a different way.
Yeah, I talked earlier in this series to Wesley Stace about this, and he pointed out that the use of the gay guitar in Gay Perry was someone establishing a sense of language that said, I'm from this other period. I'm not a modern guy. Another piece of embracing his age. I mean, obviously, you know, the language in this album is, of a certain type. One thing I thought interesting about actually all the PR and all the publicity, and I've now read all 50 whatever reviews of this album, Henry Rollins' name has not come up once in terms of, you know, what's been learned about this, right? I'm not at all saying it's a bad thing, but there's a relationship there that's a big part of the story of this album, but they've kept it out of the, you know, even the modern narrative of it.
Well, even like the Jerry Garcia connections too, I feel like were not talked about at the time. That, again, there was this weird assumption, which doesn't line up with the timeline, that Bob was talking about his own health issues, even though that happened after he made the record. But, you know, the fact that he would have been inspired by the death of Jerry Garcia, like, that's not something I remember hearing about until, you know, maybe like the last 5-10 years, like when people would talk about the record. I mean, again, I think with someone like Dylan, he just wasn't on people's radar, you know. And I don't think that, you know, when a Dylan record comes out now, and this is also true because of the internet age, but, you know, as soon as a Bob Dylan record comes out, people are doing like in-depth analyses and treating it with like the utmost seriousness and like reading into like, why did he say this? And why is he referring to that? And in 97, I don't think the mainstream press anyway was looking at Dylan records like that, you know, just because there hadn't been a Dylan record in a while that would have warranted that kind of attention. I mean, Oh Mercy, I think, was looked at as a comeback, but then you have Under the Red Sky, which is this weird misfire. And then he puts out the two really good acoustic folk records, but, you know, no original songs on those records. And like, you know, 7 years between albums of all original material. I mean, that's a really long time, you know, even though he's had longer breaks. I mean, because you had Tempest, and then the Standards records, and then Rough and Rowdy Ways. I guess that's an 8-year gap. But I don't know. I feel like that 7-year gap was probably longer in its own way than like an 8-year gap now.
Well, and it was also, you can break his career down into, there's kind of this first 15, you know, years when he can't do any wrong. I mean, there's a little bit of period in the, you know, very into the 60s, 70 or so. But then, you know, Street Legal, Born Again, all that 80s stuff was a rough time. And so that 8-year, that 7-year period came at the end of, you know, a particularly long gap from when Dylan was Dylan, demigod of the universe.
And I think too, again, like just the way he was defined was such a limiting way, the 60s troubadour, which you still get some of that when, you know, a very sort of like basic or general conversation about Dylan, like if he's on 60 Minutes or something, they might, you know, he was the voice of a generation, the protest singer, he made folk into rock and roll, all that stuff. And it was very much just like, okay, yeah, he made great music, but he's an historical figure. And and what he was able to do with Time Out of Mind really was to be like, no, I'm a contemporary figure, you know, that quote you referenced earlier where he's like, don't compare other people to me. I mean, compare other records to like what I'm doing. Don't make me go against myself. I think Time Out of Mind was a record that people did do that for, you know, like it was like, okay, we'll put this in the modern context. And it did amazingly well. by that standard, you know? And I feel like that has happened with each subsequent record that he's put out. And he's put out some great records. He's put out some okay records since then. But I feel like each record, it gets its moment in the sun where, you know, people make a pro and, you know, they'll do a pro and con against it, or they'll go deep into the songs. And we're so used to that now with Dylan. But yeah, like you said, there was a long time where people were just like, all right, a new Bob Dylan record next, you know, this is like an old 60s guy trying to, you know, put up music now. Like, this isn't really relevant to what
it's also
is also in the world.
It's also so musically different. It forces you to rethink. I think it's the only one that, you know, it could have come out when, you know, it could have come out 8 years earlier. It could have come out, you know, 10 years later. You can't even sort of put it in time anywhere. But mostly it's because of Lenoir, let's maybe say. It could be because of Bob, but it's so distinctive. You can't confuse it with, you know, kind of anything else. And the combination of that and the age and so much time going by, you know, kind of gave it that option of rethinking him.
Well, it's interesting too, because in a sense, it's like a record that harkens back to an older time. Like, there's definitely the vibe of the record is very sort of like mid 20th century, you know, blues and folk and this sort of like film noir type world almost is what it evokes. But on the other hand, it's a very modern record. You know, it feels very much like a record that, again, it wouldn't have quite the same flavor that it does if it had come out 10 years later or earlier. I think there's something about that record that I think was very influential on what became known as Americana music. You know, there wasn't really some, you know, people didn't really use that term in 97, but I think you listen to a lot of Americana records now, and I feel like there's a similar thing where it's using technology to harken back to a time before technology, which sounds like a contradictory idea, but, you know, there's a Bob Dylan quote, and I'm going to paraphrase it, but he was talking about Time Out of Mind, and he's like, I wanted to push the technology past the point where it didn't really know like what it was doing, you know, this sort of like deconstructing technology. So it breaks down and like you live in that sort of the debris of like what of this technology that you've broken. And there's so many records that came after that, that I feel like are trying to do the same thing. Like, I think Wilco, when they did Yankee Hotel Foxtrot, I think that's what they were trying to do. I think this band, The War on Drugs, who I love, a lot of their music has that same kind of thing where it's using technology, but it's also kind of broken down at the same time. And I think it just speaks to, I think a lot of those bands, they love Bob Dylan. And I think Time Out of Mind, you know, sonically, like that's what defines that record. And I think it was really influential for a lot of people.
How did you talked about its influence on you at the age you were at. Did you experience that from your peers? And, you know, was that only sort of the tight group of people who already are like-minded with you, or did you get a sense that he broke through for people for whom he was, you know, otherwise a relic?
Yeah. I mean, I think again, you know, for, you know, people my age that were into music, I mean, no, I didn't know anyone that liked Bob Dylan as much as I did. So I was like definitely in my own world there. And again, like I was already a Dylan fan when Time Out of Mind came out, but what Time Out of Mind did for me was say, oh, I have to care about the new records now too, you know, which is not something I automatically did like with legacy artists that I was discovering at the time. You know, like I wasn't necessarily thinking I have to go buy the new Paul McCartney album. You know, it's like I can listen to the Beatles and early McCartney and that's fine. I mean, I've changed my mind on that, by the way, since, but like in the 90s, I don't care about what Paul McCartney's doing now. I like the older stuff. But yeah, I mean, I think for just the typical music fan that was into new records, you know, people just took that record more seriously than they would from any other sort of 60s person. I mean, what's one thing that makes me laugh to myself when I listen to Time Out of Mind is the part in Highlands where he says he's listening to Neil Young. I love that part because Neil Young had a great period in the 90s. Like he was like the cool old rocker. You know, he was called the godfather of grunge. You know, he's like touring with Pearl Jam. You know, and then that space of time between Under the Red Sky and Time Out of Mind, you know, this gap of original material from Dylan. I mean, Neil Young's putting out Ragged Glory and Harvest Moon and like these great records that were acclaimed and embraced by younger audiences. And it's kind of funny because after Time Out of Mind, I feel like Bob took that away from Neil Young. Because Neil Young's career since 97 or so, like in the 2000s, 2010s, like his new records, a lot of them are not very good. And I say that with a heavy heart. I say that as a fan of Neil Young, but like I've heard all those albums and a lot of them are pretty bad. And Dylan, meanwhile, putting out, you know, Love and Theft and Modern Times and all these other great records, like he became the guy after Highlands, you know. But I always think of that when I hear that line, because now it would be like almost the other way around. Like Neil Young should be singing about listening to Bob Dylan, like not the, you know, not Bob singing about Neil.
That's funny. Let's talk about the box a little bit. First of all, what did you have access to early, or what have you been discovering with the rest of us in the last couple of weeks?
They sent me everything that's in there. So, some of it was like out of order, but, they sent me everything and Rosen was like, just write whatever you want. You know, like there was not a lot of guidance other than, again, me taking this angle of being like a younger Dylan fan and writing about it from that perspective. But otherwise he was like, whatever you want to write about is fine. One thing that, you know, he said to me, I don't think I'm telling stories out of school, because I think there's a producer's note about this, but I think one thing that they were sensitive about was the perception that they're trying to usurp Lanois, that they're like, you know, that this is like a FU to Daniel Lanois or something.
I noticed last night in looking at the liner notes closely in the very ending thank you credits, there's a little, not a small line, but there's a line that says like with love and respect to Daniel Lanois, right? There's kind of a final bow in the box set to him, which is nice.
Like he had said, because I had said something about the remix and just being like, I think a lot of people are going to like this because the production of Time Out of Mind has always been pretty contentious. Again, I love the production, but I know a lot of people don't. And I understand why they don't, because he's way more heavy-handed than any other producer. Like most producers are just, again, not really producing Bob Dylan. Like when you talk about a producer, normally, you know, like a proper producer is helping with arrangements and, you know, really determining sort of the sonic character of the record. And the sense you get from Dylan typically is that he's the one that does that. There's no producer who's going to tell him what to do. And Lanois did, you know, Lanois obviously had way more control than any other producer does with Dylan. So, you know, I'm sure there's, and Dylan also has been, you know, he's slagged Lanois like publicly, you know, which I'm sure that's influenced fans in terms of how they hear the record. But again, I think it's like all of these bootleg series, what is great about them is how many different perspectives they give you on songs that you already know. So you can hear all these alternate versions, and you know, no one changes up his songs like Dylan does. And even like on this box set, you know, a lot of the different versions aren't dramatically different, but they're different enough. And there's also different, there's enough like sort of altered lyrics that I think it really gives a fascinating perspective on how this album evolved. And it does seem like one of the more interesting records in that respect, just like how it changed over time and some of the, I guess, fights that went on. I mean, the box set doesn't really delve into that. I mean, you can see that in some of the retrospective articles that have come out around this box set. But yeah, I don't know. It's a great record and just a great, I think, story.
Yeah, I agree both that the new mix is great. The original mix doesn't change. I kind of think there's something in that swamp that was the magic.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I... like a song like, you know, like Standing in the Doorway. I love the new mix version, but it doesn't have the same mystery that the Time Out of Mind cut does. You know, I like hearing more of the instrumentation on Not Dark Yet. You know, you can really hear like the guitar, like slide guitar, or I'm sorry, pedal steel guitar more clearly there than you can on the original mix. But again, like, I mean, Not Dark Yet for me is probably the masterpiece of the record. Certainly, you know, like the centerpiece song. And the original one, the new mix just can't touch it, in my opinion. But there's other things. I mean, I like hearing like the new Lovesick, you know, because you hear different elements that you can't hear, you know, just picking out what the band is doing. It's a lot easier on the new mix, and you can really appreciate all the cool things going on. Whereas, you know, the original, it's more of like a wash over everything.
Completely.
And it's almost like there's no individual part. It's almost just like one big ball of sound. And on the new mix, you can break it down easier. So, you know, there's advantages to both. But I don't know. I mean, I've lived with the other version for 25 years. So, you know, this is always going to be sort of like an adjunct to what I already know, you know, for better or worse.
Yeah, and I agree. The liner notes, you know, I think Brinkley points out, the producer notes talk about it. And I think it's the reality is this is built upon that 25 years. It can't displace it. And the good thing is it doesn't. And I always think that the fact that you can't buy it, you got to buy, you know, they didn't put out 2022 standalone, you know, mix. Yeah. But you get to hear it. And I agree. You know, some of the box sets are amazing to hear, but you're not going to go back to them a lot. You know, they're either alternate, the fifth version of X or some weird take on it. I think this one just gets in rotation, all of it. Let's talk about the live stuff. I know, you know, you've got the Never Ending Stories podcast.
Yeah.
So you're thick into live, Dylan. I actually just heard your El Rey show.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know which night, but I was at one of the nights.
Oh, wow.
I saw Irving Plaza, The Troc, and El Rey. I went to three of that tour.
That's a great feather in your cap, man. Because those are amazing shows. Yeah, for our Patreon, I made a compilation of like my favorite songs from the El Rey run, like those five shows, and it was so good. I mean, and it's, you really get a sense of like the triumph that he must have been feeling at that time, you know, because he's. Like the show that we talked about, which was the 19th, December 19th, there's like, I think a quarter of the set comes from Time Out of Mind. And my co-hosts, Evan and Ian, you know, one of them was like, well, was Bob not that confident about Time Out of Mind? Because that, you know, doesn't seem like a lot. And these guys are younger. They're used to like Rough and Rowdy Ways era Dylan, where he's pretty much doing the entire album, you know? And I was like, well, in the 90s for Bob Dylan to play that many songs from a new record, I mean, that was a big deal, you know, especially since he hadn't been playing those songs before the record came out. And, you know, the album had only been out, I guess, for about 3 months at that point. But again, that's another thing that we're not used to. We're used to when you see Bob Dylan now, he's going to play a lot of new songs. And back then it was like, you know, no, like people just wanted to hear the old stuff, you know, and maybe you'd get like one or two songs that were relatively recent, but
I think people have a selective memory, because I think even right after Tempest, there was a long time when he didn't play any songs. I remember going to shows thinking there will be no new songs. That's the assumption. So that's how old I am. no way we're going to get any. But those shows were. I just happened to be in New York. I lived in Seattle for the Irving Plaza show, which was just staggering. And there's a beautiful, I think it's a soundboard of that show. So that's they're all fun.
Oh yeah.
How do you feel about what they put on the live disc, and what are your personal thoughts, even though you're an insider here, on them using audience tapes versus not?
You know, it's interesting because you know, I saw people talking about that, and I think, like, I read a story where they were saying that sometimes the audience tapes are better than like what they have themselves. So that's why they were using that. And I'm fine with, I mean, I don't know. I think it sounds good. So I don't, I'm
except
not, you know,
the two soundboards that are on there kind of disprove that.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know if they were talking about specific songs. Maybe there were specific songs where the audience tape version was just better than the soundboard. I mean, I don't have a sense of like how much Bob tapes himself. Like, I don't know if he tapes every show or not. I don't know what that is. I will say that I made a personal appeal to do a Neverending tour box set. And I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. I don't want to go too in depth with that. I don't know how much he tapes himself. I mean, that'd be a good question. I don't know if there's like tons of stuff in the vaults that are live.
Someone who claimed to know, and I've heard this multiple times, said in the 90s, especially, there was a soundboard kept for every night. Now, apparently there's soundboards of different calibers. It doesn't automatically mean it's mixable, you know, but they were taped.
Okay. I mean, that would be amazing. I would love to have some of that stuff released. But yeah, my sense is that that is not a priority for whatever reason. I mean, I don't know if... I mean, Bob's only put out one live album during the Never Ending Tour era, and that was MTV Unplugged, you know, which is weird, you know, considering how much he tours, you'd think... Because there's so many live records before that. But, you know... He hasn't put out an official live release where, I mean, there's been certain songs that get put on box sets.
It's super weird. Look, it's given the role live plays in his right career. Yeah. And how good he is at it. I mean, you know, the Supper Club, right? That's certainly on everybody's short list for a future bootleg. And we know we all have the soundboard, so we know they have them.
Yeah. I mean, I would almost want to hear something that isn't circulated, you know, like I don't need a Supper Club release because it's like I already have it, unless there's like just tons of stuff that hasn't been released. But I don't know. I mean, I don't know if there's like a fear that people won't come to the show if he puts out a live record. I don't understand, because I feel like there should be like 10.
He's the most bootleg guy, as you know, right? He's
right.
I mean, and they're permissive about it. Right, they could take him off Expecting Rain or a Dime a Dozen if they wanted. They don't. They let things like your show, frankly, right, and go on without blinking.
Right,
and I think it's to the benefit of his career.
Of course. Like that, it just encourages people to go see him. You know, and this is like a, Dylan fans are like insatiable, you know, like they're not going to turn. Like if there was a Supper Club release, I would buy it, even though I already have the bootleg. I'd still would want to, oh, maybe it sounds better. Maybe there's like two or three extra songs that I don't already have. It's weird. I feel like there should be like 10 more live albums from, you know, the last 30 years. You know, there should have been one like every 3 or 4 years. People would have bought it. It would have been great. But aside from just stray tracks on box sets, I mean, there hasn't been a proper live album. I mean, I guess you could say that, yeah, Disc 4 is, you know, that's a live album. Okay.
So and not only a, not only here. A live album, but they, as much as they could, reconstituted Time Out of Mind in order.
Right.
What I said last week is I hope they take that cue now and go back and give us, you know, live Love and Theft and give us live Tempest.
Right. Yeah. That would be great. I don't know. I wonder. I mean, because if you're gonna do a Love and Theft box set, that to me should be a de facto Neverending Tour box set. You know, just because I feel like that's such a great era live for him. And you know, I mean, honestly, I'd love a box set where it wasn't just the songs from the album. I'd love to have like a whole show on there that was just great, you know, because as we all know, it's not just about these live versions of contemporary songs. It's him doing radical reinventions of older songs, you know, and that's the stuff. Like I would love a box set where, you know, it was called Visions of Johanna and it's just 20 versions of Visions of Johanna. Like I would buy that, you know, but now we're really catering to the hardcore.
Well, and I wonder if their thought pattern is those guys have already done that for themselves.
Right.
You know what I mean? It has to come from Bob that I think the, you know, recording quality or something isn't low.
I don't know. Maybe there's a philosophy there of like, you know, you should be there. And if you're not there, then, you know, you missed it.
Well, at some point that opportunity goes away, right? I mean, just like you know, what they did with 75, which is great. You know, you can't go back to Rolling Thunder.
Right.
So it's sure great to have it.
I mean, I'm sure at some point there'll be live archival releases similar to like what the Grateful Dead does.
Or Springsteen.
Yeah. I mean, my sense is that it will be after Bob is gone. So hopefully that won't be for a really long time, but I don't know. I think if he wanted to do it, they would have done it already. But the fact that they haven't done it says something about, even though he's not that involved in these sets, from what I can tell, he does seem to have veto power over what they do. I shouldn't say that. I don't know how much say. My sense is that he's not going through outtakes and seeing like, oh yeah, let's put that one on. You know, that's just my sense.
I talked to Michael Brower last week, and he's done 9 bootleg series remixes, or mixes or remixes. He's never talked to Bob.
Right. Yeah. And you know what? Like, I think it's the best way forward with these things, because he has these people in place who really care about his legacy, you know, like starting with Jeff Rosen, you know, clearly loves the music and wants to put his best foot forward. Sometimes if the artist is too involved, they can screw things up because they don't really know. I mean, we all know that Bob Dylan sometimes does not have any clue what songs to put on a record. Like, we've all have realized that over time, you know? So if he were more involved, these sets might not be as good as they are. You know, it's like, I mean, I just don't think he cares ultimately, but him stepping aside and letting these other people, like these curators, take it. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. God love him for that. You know, he's not obsessed with his own past. You know, that's why we love him. And it's great to have these great, you know, these great curators in his midst that can put these beautiful sets together. I mean, because they really do a fantastic job.
Yeah, I was going to say, even with the whole release of Live, you know, I don't think there's any career that's been managed as well as this guy's career, period. So what Rosen and The Office does, I wouldn't begin to second guess them, because it's just, they've done such a fantastic job. And everything, the quality of this box, I mean, not just the recording, but the aesthetic, the books, the
right,
everything.
The photos are amazing.
Gorgeous.
And, you know, one thing I really appreciate too is that they have been really good about moving into areas that are underappreciated. You know, like Springtime in New York. How valuable is that box set for, you know, just giving you a totally different view of a maligned period in his career and being like, wow, there was like so much good music being made, even if a lot of it didn't end up on proper albums. Or the gospel box set. You know, I love that. There's the rumors about
Self-Portrait.
Yeah, Self-Portrait. That one in particular, I think, really changed people's perception of an era. You know, like this box set, I think it'll deepen people's appreciation of Time Out of Mind, but it's not like, oh, Time Out of Mind's a great record. I didn't know that till I heard this box set. That Self-Portrait, another Self-Portrait, it's like, yeah, that totally reinvented that era. It's like just an amazing achievement, I think, for that box set. Like, how many box sets do that? You know, not many. It's so great.
Yeah, I thought another interesting thing that Wesley Stace said to me was, you know, back in the 90s, 2000 CD era, when everyone else was reissuing their albums and tacking the extra tracks on the end, the Dylan people were smart enough to never do it so they could do these things.
That's true. That's a good point. Yeah, I mean, smart enough, but also I feel like I'd like to think that there's some respect for the fans with that, because, you know, like when you tack the extra songs on, it's just a con to get you to buy a record you already own. And there is something nice about being like, no, we're going to put it all here. It's all unreleased, all new. And you just have to get this thing. you don't have to buy like 10 records you already bought, you know? So I don't know. I like to think it's smart, but also it's respecting the people that are going to care about right. that.
Well, they also have the luxury. I don't think many people have the volume at this quality that you could do it. I mean, obviously, let alone for 17 volumes. I mean, it's ungodly. Plus, you know, three box sets that didn't count, plus Biograph. You know, I did the math one time. I don't remember now, but it's, you know, it's like 100 discs now. It's insane.
Yeah. And then, you know, you get into the bootlegs where it's like the genuine bootleg series, and there's like multiple discs of that. And yeah, it's just, it's amazing. And again, when you then factor in the live stuff, it's just like, you know, I'm going to be buying box sets from Bob Dylan and into my 80s, you know, I mean, I'll happily do it, you know, but it just seems like a well that is bottomless. And, you know, and he's still touring, and like the last, you know, the most recent tour was like amazing shows, you know, so many good recordings.
He did Shadow Kingdom, which is stunning. He recorded 6 hours, you know, 30 days of stuff for that. And that wasn't even put out. That's just some future box set sitting somewhere waiting.
Yeah. Yeah. He owns us. He owns us, man. You know, we might as well just, you know, subscribe to Bob Dylan. They could just take money directly out of our checking accounts. You know, but, you know, the best reason for me to do these liner notes is that I got a box for free. So I didn't have to pay for it this time, which was really nice. I'll have to pay for the next one, but I'll do it happily.
Look, you end your notes with this idea, you know, from the mortality music and mortality recording to immortality, which is, as the last few minutes of our discussion just validated, we've certainly got with Bob. Any last thoughts either on the experience, on what we should all think about in terms of re-listening to Time Out of Mind now, or the pleasure of being a Bob Dylan fan in the 2023?
Yeah, I mean, again, I think with Bob, any album, no matter how you feel about it, it's a chapter in a story, and it works on its own, but there's something rich about looking at any album in the context of his career. And like I said before, there's Dylan records that during a time in my life, maybe I thought, oh, this album's not any good. And then like 10 years later, I listen to it again and I'm like, it's amazing. And the thing I realize is that I can never make a proclamation about a Bob Dylan record because I will embarrass myself later on down the road. Like everything that he does is fascinating to me. It just is. And so it's hard for me to ever dismiss anything that he did. But yeah, Time Out of Mind, huge record for him. I think because of Lanois' involvement, it's really unique. And I would say to people who don't like the production that, like, I wouldn't have wanted Daniel Lanois to produce 10 Bob Dylan albums, but the two that he did, I think because of what he brings to it, they stand alone in his catalog. And it's an interesting juxtaposition with the other records that he's done. And that's not going to change. You know, I don't think he'll ever make a record like this again. I don't ever think he'll work with a producer that involved. So to work with a guy who's really a master of record production and to see what he did with the songs, I think it's just it's a beautiful thing. It really adds, I think, to what's otherwise just an excellent collection of material.
Thank you. That was great. Stephen Hayden, thank you for the liner notes. Thanks for joining us today. Thanks for helping us all revisit Time Out of Mind and think about the Fragments box set.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening.